As I was saying just before I went out, you can think of this as the equivalent of one of those how many mistakes can you find in this picture things. So this is, I'm sure, a invented survey invented by the authors of our textbook. And the question is, what are the reasons why the answers might not, in fact, be reliable? So if you look at that, which questions do you think might be distorted in what ways? The answer might be distorted.
Yeah. I think number six is unfairly ambiguous because it's unclear whether the fundamentalist part results in the bombings or the fundamentalist education results in the bombings.
All right, I would have thought that it implies that the education has, but would the main objection to that one be that it's ambiguous? Yeah?
I think it leads to an obvious answer.
What?
I think it leads to an obvious
answer. Yeah, but it is obviously loaded. That's the way you ask the question if you want people to say no, right? Whereas, do you believe that fundamentalist that religious education by a variety of different religious beliefs to maintain the cultural diversity of our society is acceptable in America? You get a very different answer. Yeah.
I don't see why it's unfair to restrict it to those types of fundamentalist religions which do in fact result in bombings in America.
That's not what it says though. Such as that. It doesn't say limited to those which.
Well, right, but such as could be construed as narrowing the scope to those which result in bombings.
All right, I think you're grammatically wrong. I may be mistaken. In any case, the real question, people read it. There's a distinction, not usually with parentheses, between restrictive and non-restrictive clauses. Whereas, as you may know, it's in ordinary writing, you separate the letter, there are commas, so that if I say, The students who live in this dorm are good students. That is restricted to the students in the dorm. If I say the students, comma, who live in the dorm, comma, are good students, that's implied that all of the students live in the dorm. So the second statement is describing rather than restricting.
I agree, except for I feel that the mention of bombings suggests a category specifically which would be characterized by bombings.
All right, maybe. In any case, either way, it is loaded to give the answer no. Whether when you interpret it, you then say, well, that only shows that kind of fundamentalists aren't acceptable, or whether it shows that fundamentalist education isn't. So that's one. Any others?
The answer choices for number one.
Yes.
I think they're a little ambiguous. I personally would confused as to whether or not I would classify myself as moderately or very religious.
And very and extremely are also, it's hard to know how those categories, it might be more useful. Well, actually, I guess the number two really is a quantitative measure in a sense, but your other?
For number three, it looks like the question invites the person to be biased.
Which direction?
Depends. If they want to express humility, perhaps they lower it. If they wanted to express their own...
The question I want to ask is whether or not they've read question four before they answer question three. Right?
Yeah.
If they look at both of them, they're going to say, wait a minute, I made $40,000 and I only gave $300 to the church. That looks pretty wimpy. Let's put it down to $30,000. Whereas, as you say, if you just take three by itself, you can imagine people exaggerating in either direction for lots of reasons. Even if we assume it's a perfectly anonymous exam, people want to have beliefs about themselves. So if you think about somebody who thinks rich people are bad, who sort of feels that he identifies with, the masses, he may try to add up the numbers, as it were, in a way that gives the lowest possible number. He may say, my income was such and such, but here's the money I had to spend in order to make it. After all, that's the way the income tax does it as deductions. So really, my income is a smaller amount. Or he might even say, it's true, last year I made 40,000, but that was unusual, so I really shouldn't put it in. And, you know, my average is only 25,000 last year. I had a windfall or something. You can think of lots of ways in which, just on what you want to believe about yourself, you would distort the facts. And the further one is if you think that it doesn't actually say whether it's anonymous. It's emailing, so it's not anonymous, right? It's emailed so the people who receive it will be able to see it. And you could then easily enough imagine, as you're saying, it says in both directions. You could imagine the person who says, I want, you know, in our society, high income is a sign of success. I want people to think I'm successful, so I'm going to pop up my income. But you could also imagine someone who says, wait a minute, if they realize how much money I'm making by my consulting, they might be unwilling to give me a raise as a professor. So therefore, I'm going to try to minimize it. You would think of either of those. But there's clearly a problem with self-reporting anything people care about, basically, especially when it's not very... Other ones? How about number four, yeah?
When you say staff, does that include, like, does that only refer to, like, the administrative people in law school, or just...
Don't know. Like, don't know what they're including. Can you think of any other problems with this as it is? Let's suppose for a moment that, I don't know when this, the book's been out for a while, so I've been teaching it for a while. Suppose this was 10 years ago or 12 years ago. Now do you see a further problem with it? I mean, I realize that you're all too young to realize that there was actually a time in the distant past when not everybody had email. Email has not existed since the time of the flood. It's a new development. So if, right at this point, it would probably be a pretty safe assumption that almost all faculty and staff at the law school have emails. 10 years ago, it probably would not be. 15 years ago, it certainly wouldn't have been. So in that case, doing it from the email directory would tend to get you, what, the younger people probably, because they're more likely to do things, to some extent the techie people, the IP, but not the property professors or whatever. So you would again have a non-random sample because of that. Right? Which is, you could do better. It probably would not be such a problem nowadays, but I don't know where this one was done. How much did you contribute last year to organized religion? Does that raise any problems? Yep.
I was just thinking of the difficulty of word religion.
That might be one that certainly people could disagree on what's an organized religion. What's, whose line? I'm trying to remember what the line is. I don't belong to any... No, it's I don't belong to any organized political party. I'm a Democrat. I think that maybe Will Rogers or someone. And you could imagine someone feeling, you know, I don't belong to organized religion. I'm a Quaker. Something of that sort. That would be one.
And then that Quaker idea, you get people perhaps confused about whether to monetize their time, things that are not usually labeled as money.
And also, for example, my wife's church does dinners for the homeless. She makes bread for those dinners. Is that a contribution to organized religion or is it a contribution to the homeless? You know, sort of think of it mechanically. If she makes the bread, gives it to the church, and the church gives it to the homeless, well, she contributed to the religion contributed to the homeless. Or if I take my case, my instinct would be to say zero in that. I don't believe in any religion. But of course, my wife, this is a community property state. On my tax form, I contribute to religion. Why? Because my wife does. She puts some amount in each Sunday at church. And she knows how much it is and tells me, and I put it on the tax form. So if I wanted for some reason to make that number large, I might decide that I should include that. But, you know, after all, I earn a good deal of that money, and, you know, it's... So, if not, not. But actually, what was bothering me about that was not that at all. It was that if you are religious and do contribute, and you want to think well of yourself, you may have an incentive, again, in your own head to exaggerate the amounts. So I think that would be at least a potential problem. Let's see, what else? I don't remember if that's all of it, or if there's... Here we go. What would you guess the histogram would be for the last digit of the telephone number?
Anyone?
Sorry, what was the question?
No, another question, since you've actually all seen this, was on the syllabus. Suppose we did a histogram for the last digit of your telephone number, what would it look like? What? You think that for some reason 5 is much more likely to be?
No, sorry, the correct signal.
You'd be flat, that's right. You'd expect. I think it would be. I don't really know how the phone company does it. I'm pretty sure that if it was for the second digit of your area code that it wouldn't be. I think, aren't those mostly zeros or ones? 408-610. I may be wrong. I think that's not a random distribution, but my guess is the last digit probably is. So that means that what the histogram would look like is something like, probably wouldn't be exactly flat, but close to flat. And I'm not really expecting you to. You're welcome. If you need the standard deviation, you want for practice, but not as soon as we both have. For the special challenge question, do you see how you would act? Not what the answer is, but how you would calculate the answer. I don't think you did. Showing that information not just for 2, but for 2.1, 2.2. If you didn't know that it was coming out about right, you could get the exact figure by looking it up on the Z-table. People now understand what a Z-table is. We have the general objection about it. Use it at some point. We'll be looking at them, but as long as you know. All right, let me...
That's really all. Unless you think there's something else wrong with this, which I've forgotten. PowerPoint, and this is where we were at the beginning.
Wanted to go over this one more time because it's a slightly subtle but important distinction, and that's that we have got on the one hand the characteristics of the full distribution, and on the other hand what we can learn about that from the characteristics of the particular sample we look at. Almost all statistical cases, you're looking at some subset. You've polled a certain number of students, or you've looked at data from the census, which in some areas only reaches 1% out of 10 or something. And so the question is, how do you estimate the characteristics of the group from the sample? And the answer turns out to be that the mean of the sample is an estimate of the mean of the group. That on average, you can sort of see if you took lots and lots, took enough samples, you get the whole group. So therefore, the average, each individual mean will probably not be exactly on, but the average of those means will be. All right. Standard deviation, though, that's not true, because the standard deviation for the sample is being calculated from the sample mean, and if the sample happens to be a little high, the sample mean will be a little high, so the standard deviation will look a little lower than it really is. And it turns out that the rule for that is that you calculate standard deviation dividing by n minus 1 instead of n. And the easy way of remembering that, not the reason it's true, is to say that tells you that you can't tell the standard deviation for sample size of 1, because 1 minus 1 is 0. 0 over 0 is undefined. So that's the distinction. And something we'll be talking about in a little bit is the characteristics of the sample data. So imagine for a moment what we're doing. If we say that the distribution of heights is normal, which it probably isn't, we're saying if we pick you at random, you're going to be here. And we pick her at random, and she's going to be here. And pick me at random, and I'm going to be here. That very normal one with samples. I'm going to pick him at random, he's up here. Pick him at random, and he's up here. And if we pick enough people, we would have lots of them in here and fewer of them in there. All right? That's not the same question as saying, suppose we picked 10 people, took their average height, and wrote it down. Can you see that instead of doing our experiment one by one, we did 10 by 10, we would get a much tighter distribution? Because if we pick 10, it's very unlikely they would be all short, although it's quite likely that one person will be short. Very unlikely they'll be all tall. So the 10, as it were, are averaging it out, and they won't be exactly there. So if you're asking, if the experiment consists of picking 10 people and learning something about them, you want to know the distribution, not of the individual ones, but of the results of that kind of experiment. You might say each time you pick 10, how like, so the standard deviation of the mean of your group of 10 is a different number from the standard deviation of the individual in the sample. Does that make sense or not? I'm a little bit of a puzzle. I'm not sure I'm saying. Well, let's keep going, so I'll come back to that. So, review. We've got different ways of summarizing data. We discussed the fact. Yep.
Would you pick the same number of samples in both of those examples? So, if you pick them 10 at a time, or you pick them one by one, are you going to take the same number samples total?
I'm saying that if you pick them one by one, the standard deviation of what you got would be very different from if you pick 10, took the average of that, pick 10, took the average, even the total number you got. Right? Even if you ended up doing 10 times as many in the one cases, looking just at those ones, you're going to get a Y curve, whereas looking at the averages of groups of 10, you're going to get a narrow curve.
Okay.
It turns out standard deviation goes down as the square root of the number.
Thanks.
So standard deviation, Chebyshev's rule, tells you basically, independent of whether it's normal or not, what's the largest amount of the sample that can be more than a standard deviation away or more than two standard deviations away. And the way, if you ever want to calculate it yourself and you like math, all you do is to say, if I were trying to arrange these 20 items so as to get as many as possible just over one standard deviation away, how many can I get? And that's Chebyshev's rule, and simply. So, the point I started with is that in statistics you want to think both about how you learn things and about how you persuade people, because both of those are going on, and even if you are strictly honest, the people you're talking with may not be, and therefore you want to think in terms of how different ways the same data could be presented, which lead to different conclusions, because even if you're not trying to fudge the results, it is quite possible that people presenting the results as you are. The normal distribution is a particular shape, and the shape is defined by the mean, by where the center of the bell curve is, and by the standard deviation, which is how much it's stretched out. And given those two numbers, you could draw the normal distribution. And because they're all the same in that respect, that means that a single table will tell you for every possible normal distribution, will let you figure out how likely it is that a number is more than some distance away from the mean. All right? Makes sense?
Yes.
The Warren Buffett is supposed, if I remember correctly, to have described himself as a five sigma event. This is in his arguing against the efficient market hypothesis. Right? The efficient market hypothesis in its strongest form says you can never make anything more than a normal return on the stock market because all stock prices already reflect all the available information about the company. So if somebody says, look, this company announced last week that they had made and struck oil, let's buy their stock, the answer is we were going to buy it, and everybody who would sell it already knows they struck oil. And the general argument, and you can make stronger or weaker forms of this, which I think we discussed earlier in the early part of the book, but you could, in the full version, you say the only reason one person does better than another is he's lucky. Because all of the information the expert investor might have is already incorporated in prices. And Buffett says, well, that's a very interesting claim. Let's look at how lucky I have been. Well, he says, and I expect it is true, looking at the random variation in the stock market, I am 5 standard deviations away. The probability that of all the people who would ever invest in anybody would be that far from the mean is very close to zero. Therefore, the theory is wrong. And I'm summarizing from the industry readers, so I can't quote him exactly. But that was implicit in saying he's 5 sigma. And it's a useful way of thinking because you can say, if he's right, maybe Buffett isn't just lucky. In general, you know, somebody says, I made a lot of money on the stock market. Well, I made a lot of money on the stock market on a couple of occasions, but it doesn't necessarily mean that you take my advice. It might just mean that those were the cases when I guessed right. And we're going to be getting into what's called hypothesis testing, which is you have a theory, such as stock market returns are random. How do you test these? And that's one of the large things. And the final point is that while distributions often aren't normal, it turns out that what you're looking at is the distribution of the average of the sample. All right, so we have some population with a non-normal distribution, and we pick 20 people from that population and take their average height. Pick another 20 people, take their average height. Pick another 20 people, take their average height. Do this 1,000 times. Look at the distribution of those results. It turns out that those will tend to be closer to normal. And the bigger the number of people we're picking, the closer to normal it is. So that means that even when the underlying distribution isn't normal, the distribution of the means of samples tends to be, and that's very useful if you want to be able to use your z-table when you're doing the kind of experiment which involves a sizable sample from a probably non-normal distribution looking at its average. So, as I said, again, there's no reason you should know why that's true. If I can't reproduce it, there's no reason you should be able to. But it's useful to know that it's true. All right. So, let's think about the difference between two different things that you might do. And one of them, which you could very easily run into in your professional careers, is testing hypothesis. So that somebody says, in a certain sense, in which you will be spending, well, some of you, those of you at least who go into criminal law, maybe other areas as well, will be spending most of your life testing hypotheses. What's the hypothesis you're normally testing in a criminal trial?
Guilt,
right. Did this guy commit the murder? And there are also lots of civil cases. Does the defendant firm discriminate against women? You know, it's pretty obvious that if the firm has one employee who is a man, that's not good evidence they're discriminating against women. If they have 2 employees who are men, that's still not good evidence. If they have 1,000 employees and 980 of them are men, then unless there's some particular reason why this is a job that men do and women don't, it becomes pretty strong evidence they're discriminating against women. All right, so you can use statistics to say how likely is it that this particular outcome could have occurred by chance when our alternative hypothesis is an explanation of the outcome. Right, that's a way of putting what you're doing. And if you run through the examples that I give, some of them are political issues. John Lott, who's an ex-student of mine, co-authored a journal article many years ago which offered evidence that allowing people to carry concealed handguns reduced certain categories of crime, reduced confrontation. And the initial reaction to the article was a whole bunch of basically demagogic pieces saying he was wrong. But then the later reaction was serious statisticians who looked at his data, which was made available, analyzed it in different ways. Some of them said he was wrong, some of them said he was right. And by that time, the level of the argument got to a level which I don't consider myself competent to participate, so I can't offer you any real opinion as to whether the current evidence is that he was right or wrong. Current evidence, however, is that John, who is a very energetic, right, productive guy, ended up spending a whole lot too much of his time becoming a partisan of a particular political fight instead of going on to do more interesting academic work. So I advise against people doing that. I've long argued that the right tactic in most of these cases is fire and forget. Say what you have to say about the subject, let other people argue, or you go do something else. Anyway, so that's a case where obviously it's a politically hot issue. That, you know, you're in a state, someone in the legislature says we ought to have a shall issue law. What's a shall issue law? A shall issue law says whoever gives out permits for carrying concealed handguns must issue them unless they can show a good reason not to. And at this point, I think maybe a majority of states have it, and a lot of research is probably one of the reasons why. But I should say, the political effect of the research, I regret to say, probably doesn't depend very much on whether he's right or not. Because I've seen an awful lot of people summarizing that controversy who obviously haven't actually read the article, looked at the statistical arguments on both sides. They believe either that it does, either that it's right or it's wrong, according to whether it fits their initial political views. Does capital punishment deter? That's even an older one. Again, the death penalty is a lively political issue still. It has been for a long time. How would you find out whether capital punishment deters? The case where there was a classic article which got a result people didn't like.
Any idea? Wouldn't you have to go to the variable of deterrence, which would require you to get actual data on those who opted not to commit crimes?
Well, that would be really nice if you could do it, but it doesn't strike me as something you'd be likely to have. Yeah?
I mean, you compare, like, countries or states who do or do not have the death penalty.
That would be one way of doing it. Can anybody see why that would be a very misleading result?
It's a very complex issue.
No, not a complex issue. Why might that give you exactly the opposite? Let me put it differently. Why might it be the case that the death penalty does deter, and yet what you just described would say it didn't? Because this was an argument being made back before. This is what I would think of as a serious statistical analysis. Somebody said what I think was true. On average, states with the death penalty have higher murder rates than states without. Why is that not as good an argument as it seems to me?
Because they might be correlated. Like, if your state has a higher death rate, you might have.
Because you don't know which direction the causation is in.
Yeah.
Because it might be the case that states with a lot high murder rate, people feel really strongly about murder and therefore are willing to vote for a death penalty. It might be that states which have a culture which thinks of killing people as sort of acceptable, both in at the individual level results in murder and at the state level results in death penalty. You have to know. So the right way to do it, which is almost never an option in practice, would be to say, let's take a bunch of states and we're going to flip coins. Heads, you have to have a death penalty for the next 10 years. Tails, you can't have a death penalty for the next 10 years. That would be the sort of proper controlled experiment. And I've been arguing for some years now that things like World of Warcraft are beginning to make that kind of experiment for something is doable, because you've got a whole bunch of little worlds, servers, each populated by some thousands of real people who are playing the game on that server, and you could imagine for some, not obviously with death penalty for capital punishment, but you could imagine for some research questions saying, all right, we're going to randomly pick half the servers and do X, half the servers and do Y, and see what happens. Sort of an exciting possibility, which I'm not sure is that much exposed to yet. But anyway, but the basic point is that that your state level data isn't really going to tell you. It was what was routinely cited against capital punishment in the early stages of the argument. And the way, well, we'll really be getting next week into the way in which you try to do it, but it amounts to trying to say, what are all of the variables that appear to determine the murder rate? Any guesses? What if you were trying to predict the murder rate for a state, what number, or for a country or whatever, what things do you think would be most likely to tell you whether they had a higher or lower degree, leaving aside them? I don't know if that's true or not. That would be an interesting question, whether dense populations give you. Yep.
Economic distribution. So, like, the wealth disparity?
Might. You could argue that poor people like to kill rich people because they don't think very highly of them. They might be able to steal some money. That would be a possibility. Yep.
Two possibilities are one that you cited, like, what's the cultural attitude towards death? And second, maybe the weather.
Maybe. You're all missing what I suspect to be the highest one, which is what fraction of the population is young adult males. Because young adult males both crash cars and kill people considerably more than other demographic groups do. Yep.
Is there any population where young adult males make up more or less?
Yeah, sure.
Than any other population?
Yes, of course. Iran, young people make up a much larger fraction of the population than in Italy. Because Iran had... I can't remember the details, but I think it was basically something like that for a period of a decade or two, government policy was promoting high birth rates. They were rewarding people who having children. And then I don't remember the details. I think earlier than that, there was some reason why birth rates were low, and maybe why they had the policy. But in any case, I saw the figure somebody gave them a couple of years ago, and that's a population heavily skewed to the younger age groups. Meanwhile, as you may know, a number of European countries have birth rates below replacement at this point. So at least if you look at native-born, they also have immigrants who are going to be young. If you look at native-born Italians or French, you're going to find a relatively old population, or Japanese in other countries. This is true with people who are young.
I think India has a high young male population.
I wouldn't be a bit surprised.
Because they value the Indian
they have, you're right.
They had marriage problems. Arranged marriages and not young girls now to go.
That is both India and China and maybe some other places. You're right. There's also, I was thinking of the age, but there's also a gender skew. And that's because, basically there are quite a lot of societies where couples prefer to have a son than having a daughter. And the traditional solution to this problem with the old technology was infanticide. If you think about classical Greece, they exposed infants they didn't want for any reason, and one of the reasons was they were daughters. I think that may be one of the things that Muhammad prohibited in Arabic society, if I remember correctly, or at least argued against. But the modern technology, the almost modern technology, is you use amniocentesis early in the pregnancy to find out what the gender of the fetus is, and you then abort if it's the gender you don't want. And at this point, there's a much better technology available, though I'm not sure how available it will be in places like India or China, and that is ways of separating out sperm that carry X chromosomes from sperm that carry Y chromosomes. You probably know that the sex of the infant is entirely determined by the sperm, because all eggs have two X chromosomes, because all women's cells have two X chromosomes. In fact, all eggs have one X chromosome, but they start out with two. Whereas the male start out with an X and a Y, and it's a point of which one goes into the sperm. So anyway, so there are now techniques for separating out the sperm such that they can't get perfect control, but they can get way off 50-50, I think, in either direction for people who want to. So the result is that in those societies, I'm not sure what the numbers are now, but there may be maybe 95, that is maybe 45, 50, probably not just 45, 55, but there's a skew of 5% or so, and more than that in some areas in the gender ratio. So that's right, that's another thing that might do it. And it might be worse than that, because it might be, I'm not sure, that not only is this a society with a lot of young adolescent men, but it's a society with a lot of young adolescent men who want to find girlfriends and wives, and there aren't many girlfriends and wives, and one of the things that can lead to is violent conflict. You're showing what a manly man you are by really beating somebody else up. Sort of a traditional approach to courtship, even if it may not be not a very attractive one. So in that sense, it might. But anyway, the basic procedure is you try to find everything that affects the murder rate, and then see whether controlling for everything else, whether you have capital punishment. And if you do it right, you do it across both space and time. That is to say, you look at 50 states over however long a period you've got data for, because some of the states will have either adopted or abolished capital punishment during that period, and that gives you more data. There are other things you can do, but that's That kind of approach in which you try to figure out everything else that is relevant to control for that and see what one variable does is what multiple regressions, which we'll be talking about next time. Alright, so the other next, I was mentioning, is the defendant firm discriminating against women. That's hypothesis testing. Hypothesis they do. The alternative is they don't. Look at the data the data support the claim they do. Get into how you do it in a few minutes. Does mercury and vaccine cause autism? This is, you may know there was a fairly substantial movement arguing that vaccination was responsible for autism. I think the opinion of most of the experts is that it isn't true, and this is a dangerous belief, but it is ultimately a statistical question. If you think about the law school, does an extra semester of torts increase spark acid? You can try to use statistics. Again, you see the problems in doing this. Suppose we ask, did the students, I'm assuming there's probably an extra semester of torts, I don't know. I know less than any other faculty member about how this curriculum was arranged, but in law school. Suppose you have a school where the first semester of torts is mandatory and the second is optional. And suppose it turns out that the students take the second semester have a higher bar pass. Do we conclude that everybody should have to take the second semester? Because? Because it's not a random sample, and it might be the case that better students were the ones who chose to take it. You don't know that. Right. So that's. Now, you could do it if you had a random. If you said, all right, it's mandatory for half the class and the other half, we're going to flip a coin for each person, that might not be very nice for the students, but it would be a good way of getting some data on whether it worked. And you could think about other cases so that, for example, if you think about K-12 education and your question is, would it work better or worse if people did it a little younger? Well, generally, any particular school system has a particular day of the year, which is the cutoff for determining when you go into first grade. So if you compare people born a day before and a day after that cutoff, you're going to get people almost exactly the same age, some of whom went to school a year older than the others. So if you looked at their performance, that would be a nice natural experiment figuring that out. The other thing you do, which is really a different use of the same tools, is to estimate population characteristics. So that as opposed to saying, is this hypothesis true or false, what you're trying to do is to say, what is our estimate of how many people in the American population are going to vote for Mr. Obama in the 2008 election? And how do you do it? Well, assume for a moment, just to make life easy, that you have some infallible test for a single person who will vote for. So you ask them and everybody tells the truth for some odd reason. And everybody knows, which of course you don't know until you will go into the polling booth. But suppose they did, then the way you do it is you pick 100 people and you ask them. And then the problems are the kind of problems we discussed. First, how do you make sure your 100 are a random sample of voters? And second, is a given the result for 100, how good prediction is that to vote for the result for 200 million? Or however many are going to vote, 100 million probably. So, average height of adult American, and in some cases at least, you not only want to know what the average is, you also want to know the standard deviation, and you want to know how sure you are that what you're saying is true. Right? Which has to do with some quantitative and some non-quantitative ways which you could think about. Let's take a case which you might easily run into as lawyers, and that's DNA testing. And suppose that the prosecution says, we've done the DNA testing, comparing the blood of the victim with the blood stains on the defendant's clothes, and our scientific result is there's only one chance in 100 million that the stain that is not a match. There's only one chance in 100 million that by pure chance somebody who hadn't gotten stained from that person's blood would have blood that looked that much like it is. What's wrong with that statement? I'm going to assume that they did their math right. They did their science right. Why is the statement nonetheless certainly false? Let me put it differently. How might you know that such statements were false? from real world evidence, as opposed to how much you figure out in advance. I think that's right. Statement is, there's only one chance in 100 million that this person, that the blood stains on these clothes did not come from this person. Let's put it that way. I'm leaving out the question, maybe he isn't the murderer, but just, you know, stopped by the body later or something. But just the question is, did these blood stains come from this victim? Yep.
I don't know, this is kind of a guess, but maybe the relevant math actually tells you what the probability of that kind of blood stain, that you get that kind of blood stain, if the proposition were not true.
That's what it's going to tell you, but, yep.
You know, you have to see, like, you'd have to look at the population of that area that could have done, right?
That
so that's, like, the hit rate, but... You have to look at, like, the population of the city.
That might be one relevant question, is it might turn out that this city is ethnically very uniform, and therefore the variation of the DNA of the blood isn't as much as a whole population. That would be a legitimate. I would think of a much bigger problem, much more real-world problem. And that is the chance that the DNA will match this close, maybe 1 in 100 million, but the chance that the guy who did the test faked it, because he was a lazy bum who didn't know how to do these tests and wanted to keep his job, may not be very high, but it's got to be more than 1 in 100 million. That is to say, implicit in the argument is the assumption that only one of the possible causes of the error is there. And if you think of all the ways, let's take another way the error could happen. It would certainly be possible that somebody accidentally switched, in the process of submitting these things, the blood stain on his clothes with the blood stain on a second sample of the victim's blood. Maybe switched a piece of cloth from the victim's clothing with a piece of cloth from the defendant's clothing. So one way, when you put it as, you know, scientific certainty, even if your math is all correct and your science is all correct, you're just assuming out a whole bunch of sources of human error. Now, we know that those sources are there because there are big cases. There was a case in Texas where it turned out that the lab that was doing it was lying. That they were not, in fact, doing the tests, they weren't confident in the tests, and Texas eventually had to retry, I don't remember which it was, like several hundred people. And, you know, you really know enough about the world to know things like that happen. An interesting question would be how you could reduce the chance of those happening. But that's an interesting one. Suppose, imagine that you are the governor of the state, and there's been a terrible scandal in some other state of this sort. What might you do in order to be reasonably sure that the labs that are doing your DNA tests are honest? Yeah. No. Anybody? Yeah.
Retest? So, like, have multiple places
tested. That's right. One possibility of multiple places tested, with the understanding that if they disagreed, the result is not simply to change your verdict, but you then investigate both of them with third and fourth testings and fire the ones that do a bad job. Alternatively, suppose you only have one lab. Something you could do is to send in samples where you know whether they match and not tell them that's what you're doing. You could have some standardized mechanism for sending in samples, and one sample out of 50 consists of your pricking your own finger, making two different stains and sending them both. And one sample out of 50 consists of your pricking your finger, your wife pricking her finger, sending those two stains in. If the first two don't agree or the second do, you know that they're incompetent. These, in general, are not popular proposals for reasons you might be able to figure out. But if you think about it from the scientific standpoint, those are the kinds of things that you would do if you wanted to answer questions. All right. So anyway, so those are two different things that one's doing in statistics, hypothesis testing and estimating. I discussed already the sample versus population, and I went through that already. Let's take my last question, though. Suppose we do this experiment, we measure the students in one class, and calculate the mean and standard deviations. So first, what does it tell you about law students at SCU? What are the sources of error you ought to be worrying about? One of them is just the statistical error, the fact that only a certain number of them, it's not the whole population, so some variation, so you can get an estimate of the mean or an estimate of the standard deviation. But why might it be wrong? Suppose we do it in this class. What's wrong with this class? Is this class a random sample of SCU students? It's
mostly guys.
And there are no first-year students here. Right? It's a class which is limited to later than first-year students. Now, that may not affect height very much, given the age of law students. It would certainly affect age, for example, if you were looking at that. So the point is only that a single class is quite likely to be non-random in one way or another, and you're going to want to think about that. Yep.
Also, it would depend on the class size. This class isn't very big, so it's likely to fall outside of the mean.
So you couldn't get a sample that was the full class, that's right. So from that standpoint, you'd be better off if you took one of the first year classes, which I'm going to assume students are randomly assigned to and all the students go to it. That would give you better data for that kind of thing. You want to think about that. How about students at SCU in general? Why is it going to be misleading for that?
Predominantly white.
You think that which? That the students at the university relative to the students at the law school? We're using the law school as a measure of students at SCU.
Are you trying to compute law school?
I'm trying to compute. Sorry, I was assuming that we were doing the experiment described, and we want to know what the experiment tells you about SCU students. Yep.
I don't know, but the law school may be populated by more men or more women.
Likely, but it is certainly populated by older people. And at this point, men often do not have their full growth at 18. They might. So if you're thinking about the students, that's going to include some 18-year-olds. It included one 14-year-old a few years ago. She interviewed me about something. I told her she beat me by 2 years. And it almost certainly includes some 17-year-olds and maybe a few 16-year-olds. 14-year-olds are very unusual, of course. So the fact that the law school is a graduate school means that people are older. So in that respect, that will have at least some effect on height. As you say, it might be a different gender mix. Might well be a different ethnicity mix. I would guess that there are probably, I'm guessing there are more foreign-born students in the law school than in the school as a whole. Certainly I see show up in some of my classes. And I don't know if it's still the case that Americans are taller. It certainly was the case if you go back 30 or 40 years. In particular, when a lot of the adults had been children during World War II, and a lot of the world, things were pretty bad during World War II. So it was quite striking visiting Japan, and I suppose it would have been the 1960s. My father's comment was that he really liked Japan because the country where he was tall. He's my height, roughly. He wasn't my height, roughly. And so it might well still be the case, I'm not sure. But that kind of thing would affect it. How about the law school as a sample of the country? Why would you get a much too high figure for the average height if you were using the law school students as a sample for the country? Yep.
Maybe you could use the same argument that because they're able to go to graduate school, they're probably able to have nutrition themselves.
I haven't thought about that. That might well be the case. What I would think of is a much simpler one, and that is that nobody in law school is 2 years old. Right? The average height for the country are going to include the babies and the toddlers and the little kids. And they, of course, aren't included here. So that would be one respect. And then for the world, you then have the question of in what ways Americans, which is most of the people here are going to be different from people from other places in terms of things like that. At least at one time, I think the difference was quite sizable. That the U.S. was in World War II, but we were a very rich country at the time. By world standards, as a result, it didn't really involve much of the starvation. So sources of error that we've just been running through. One of them is sampling error, but another is bias, and that's those ones that escape. Another one is validity, so take age rather than height. Some people want to pretend to be older and some younger than they really are for different reasons. And obviously questions like drug use and adultery and so forth, that people will have reasons. And except for the sampling error, all of these are cases which might be an accident, or it might be that the person who does the study knows what answer he wants to get, and therefore deliberately picks a sample which will give that answer.
All right.
Something we may come to later, but it's worth thinking about, and that is that when you see data asserted, what you're seeing is not a random sample of the experiments. That is, imagine that on some politically interesting question, say the rate of rape or the rate of fraud or something, that a bunch of different academics do studies. Which are the studies you're most likely to hear about? Yep.
The ones that are very surprising.
That's right. The ones at the tail, the ones that say that the rate of this crime is 10 times what everybody else says it is. So you're going to have to worry about the fact that things are being filtered in that way. And of course, there's a second effect, and that is, suppose you're an aspiring young academic doing such a study, and you would like to be at a better university than you're at, you'd like to get tenure, things like that. It might occur to you that if you could jiggle the study to get really high numbers, you'll be in the New York Times, you'll be a star, and your school will promote you or someone else will hire you.
Why is it that the outliers would be reported more than...
Because they're more newsworthy.
Why is it that outliers are more newsworthy than establishing the existing social norms?
Well, if the reporter knew what the truth was, it might not be. But from the reporter's standpoint, if you see a study which says murder rate is about what the FBI says the murder rate is, it doesn't look like a news story to me. If you see a study which says we've independently checked and the FBI is way off, there are five times anyone being killed as the FBI thinks, that's a headline. Right? Seems right to me at least. So that's one of the things that you're going to have to worry about. A further effect along the same lines is that for many of these things, there are some people who care what the number is. So if you're campaigning against autism, you're going to pick the study that shows the highest autism rate. I remember seeing this in an entirely non-political context a long time ago. And that was, as I may have mentioned, one of my hobbies for a very long time has been a group that does historical recreation for the Middle Ages and Renaissance. And once in a while, you would put on, you would have an event, and a reporter would come by. And the reporter would ask you questions. And one of the standard questions is, how many people are there in this organization? And if you're reasonably careful, you're going to give a nuanced answer. You're going to say, well, the number of people for whom this is really their major hobby, the sort of the hardcore members for whom this is what they have to spend their time, that's only 1,000 in the country. I would guess. I don't really know exactly. Probably higher than that now. Suppose I said that. The number of people who were officially members of the organization, meaning they send in $10 a year and are on the mailing list, that's probably 5,000. The number of people who show up at least one of our events during the year, many of whom are not officially members, that's probably 10,000. You're the reporter doing a report on this interesting and exotic event. Which number do you say? 10,000. I've done the experiment. I've observed the phenomenon. Because, again, something weird being done by 10,000 people is more interesting than weird being done by 1,000 people. And you can see that in a lot of other contexts. So all I'm saying is that you do have to think about that, about both intentional and unintentional biasing.
Were you talking about the Society for Creative Anachronisms?
Correct. Yes. It's anachronism, activity, not a thing, but yes. I've been involved with that for about 40 years to varying degrees. So sampling error, then, is something we've really been talking about implicitly or explicitly for a while, and that is that when you pick three students at random, there's no reason to expect their height to be higher or lower, but it's not likely to be the same as the average for the whole population, and the bigger the sample, the smaller that problem. And then the distinction that's used, which is worth knowing about, is between the statistic and the parameter. The parameter describes the population. The statistic is the number you got from your experiment. And you're using the statistic to try to estimate the parameter. So that you say, somewhere out there is a true average height of SCU law students. God knows it. And we can find out if we did enough work and measured every single one of them. We, however, only measured three of them. their average height was 5'8". So that's our estimate for the average height. We know it's not a very good estimate. So a statistic which we're trying to estimate the perimeter. 100 students, we'd have a better estimate. We've just run through this problem and go through it again. The bias is not the case where it differs because you happen to only pick three and they just happen to be. It's the case where there's some predictable difference. For example, if you estimate support for a bill by constituents' letters, what's wrong with that? Who are the people who won't write letters?
Constituents that don't care.
The people who don't care a lot. So that insofar as you're getting a measure, it's really how many people are strongly for it or how many people are strongly against it, which may not be what you might be what you want to know, might not be. There are other biases, though, because you're also only getting the kind of people who prefer to write letters. To take a different case, it's almost routine for me at this point. If I read a book and disagree with something in it, what I think is an interesting way, to go online, see if I can find an email address for the author, and email them. And I suspect that a great majority of readers don't do that. And I think the reason is not that I feel more strongly than other people, but that what I like to argue with people, I've sort of gotten used to the fact that everybody's within hand's reach, as it were, on the internet, and therefore it seems natural to do that. At least if everybody in the world acts that way, then it must be very few of my readers who disagree with me, because I don't get nearly as many emails as I ought to telling me that I'm wrong. Travel opportunities for a class in international trade. That's not a random set of students. Those are students who are especially interested in international stuff. What's wrong with calling, getting your jury pool by calling phone numbers between 12 and 5 on weekdays? What are you getting at? Calling home phone numbers. What?
Retired people.
Get retired people. Who else?
Unemployed.
What? Unemployed people. Somebody said students. And stay-at-home wives. Right? So you're excluding employed people in sort of ordinary kinds of jobs where you're working during those hours. So how about looking at the top of the crate of apples to estimate how many of them are rotten? What's wrong with that experiment?
That's the area where they're most likely not to be rotten.
Either because the guy packing the crate wanted it to look good, or even if he's perfectly honest, because after he finishes packing the crate, he looks at it. He said, "Oh, that's a rotten apple. Throw it out." He doesn't see the rotten one 2/3 of the way down. So that would be biased. Estimate support for Ron Paul by an online poll. If you believe that, he should be president of the U.S. I think that may be true. I'm not sure. It certainly is true that in general, libertarians are heavily overrepresented online. With the result that that kind of a poll is going to give you a misleading result for that. I don't know if it's only libertarians or if it's also that the online community as it now exists, so people who engage in that are like, are more likely to be people at the extremes. But in any case, but all of those would be examples of problems with your sampling bias as opposed to your sampling bias. So suppose you want to control for it. Right. Take the case where, as I say, you're getting some information in some way, but you're a daytime student, and you realize that's going to undercount the part-time students. So one way to do it is to reweight your sample. One way to do it is to say, all right, in calculating my averages, I'm going to count each of the part-time students as if he was five identical. And that way, that will control, if it turned out, suppose it's the case, I don't know if it is, that the part-time students, they age, that would be a good one, actually, because they age, they really are going to be on average older. So suppose you're looking at age rather than height, and you say, if I just look at the people who in my daytime classes, I'm going to get too young in age, so I'm going to undercount the part-time students. But that's all right, as long as some of the part-time students are in my classes, I will just count each of them as if it was five people. I will weight them five times as heavily as everybody else, and the result will be to get me back to the right average age. Think about it, because the average age is the average of the full-time and the part-time students weighted by the numbers of full-time and part-time, and I've just fixed on everything. So that's one way of doing it. Can you see where there might be a risk in that procedure?
Yeah.
how might it mess you up?
You don't know how many or how big the variation is within that 20%. So
that is, in particular, it might turn out that the night students are different in some consistent way than the day students. Right? I don't know enough about part-time students to know what it was, and it wouldn't be astonishing if it turned out that the night students were employed people who had to work at night, and the day students were, I don't know, maybe younger people who were just doing it more slowly, or retired people, or some other category. Yeah.
Since controlling for the sample taker's failures,
yes.
What about when the sampling comes, when essentially the sample is self-selected? So say you want to like find the information for a certain population.
Yes.
But the sample is self-selecting, and you want to eliminate that self-selection.
Well, okay. Let's take the case for a moment of maybe height would be a good case. Suppose you're...
One that I'm really interested in is like, say you want to pull people at the mall, and so you put a person that stands in the mall with one of those clipboards.
Right.
But only certain kinds of people are willing to stop for that clipboard guy.
Right.
But you want to know everyone. Yes.
What I was thinking of is if you have a case where what you might be able to do, it depends on how it's being biased, but you might be able to do a fancier version of this. You might be able to say that if you believe that the 40-year-olds who are willing to talk to your clipboard guy are a random sample of 40-year-olds, and the 30-year-olds are a random sample of 30-year-olds, that what makes them more or less willing isn't relevant to what I guess that's got to be that there are reasons why maybe more 30-year-olds than 40-year-olds talk to you, but that among the 40-year-olds there isn't a bias between what to do and don't talk. If that were the case, you could then renormalize your sample in this way. But it might well not be the case, of course, and so you may not be able to do it. They may not be able to. Yep.
I'm not suggesting there's a perfect solution, yep. But I mean, you can incentivize them by offering them.
Yeah, sure, offer them a cookie if they'll do it. That's right. Yeah, but you're right that one way of reducing that problem is to give people a reason to do it. And similarly, if you're doing a poll by email, you might follow up on the people who don't answer. You could imagine, for example, you do your poll and only 30% of people answer. Take the other 70%, randomly choose a tenth of them, and send interview. You've done the random, you can afford to interview because only a smaller number, and you've done the randomization over the non-answerers. Assuming you can get the information by the interview, you can then properly weight it in with the rest of your sample. So that kind of method, those are all possible methods, but it's not like I'm having to consultate. But the other risk, of course, is that you might end up in a case where some particular category you have very few actual people, and therefore the uncertainty introduced in that category is much larger than it seems to be. So suppose it turns out that when you do this, your figures show 15 part-time people. Well, an average of 15 people, that should be pretty good. Those 15 are really only 3 people, each counted 5 times. And it's not unlikely that those 3 people are all unusually tall or unusually old or unusually young or something like that. So that you're going to have a problem with outliers having too much of an influence. Sampling validity, we've really suggested that already. And the Harvard questionnaire was partly about that, about the fact. So you have to be, I mean, it says any time you see a news story which says, you know, the poll shows people support X or Y, you would like to be able to see the questions because it is pretty easy to design, in many cases, to design questions such that they will cause more. Alright, hypothesis testing, let's now get to the sort of the fancy version, because this is the version, the full-scale version, which in my opinion most people who use it don't understand and misunderstand what you were talking about a little bit ago. And that is that the standard logic of the situation is that you have a null hypothesis, which is the version of your theory not being true that you're considering as an alternative to your theory being true. So in a nice simple example, the null hypothesis, you're going to experiment with a coin to see if it's a fair coin by flipping it and seeing how many heads and how many tails there are, and the null hypothesis is it's a fair coin, that half the time it'll come up heads and half the time it'll come up tails. And the question is it true? And it matters what your alternative hypothesis is. That if you have a reason to think that if it's not fair, it's been biased towards heads. Suppose you know that there, for some reason, there's some manufacturing defect that sometimes gives coins that are more likely to come up heads. Or suppose you know that there are gamblers out there who are making bets that depend on the coin coming up heads, and that there's a market of producing coins for them. So if there's some reason why if it's not fair, you think it's heads, that's a different case from where not fair includes heads and tails. Why? Because suppose you flip the coin 10 times and you get 7 heads. That's better evidence that it's a coin biased towards heads than it is that it's a biased coin. Because, after all, 7 tails would be equally good evidence for a biased coin, but evidence against biased towards heads. Let me take what's called a two-tailed test, which is my hypothesis the coin is unfair, but I don't know how. And then what the standard experiment consists of, you do an experiment, and you calculate, if the null hypothesis is true, how likely is it that the evidence against it would be as strong as this? So how do you do that? You say, well, I flipped the coin 10 times and it came up 7 heads. How likely is it that a fair coin would come up 7 heads out of 10? That you can calculate. Very straight mathematics. But that doesn't really answer the question, because in asking was this an unusually strong evidence, well, if it had come up 8 heads, that would have been even stronger evidence. 9 stronger, 10 stronger. So the real question is, how likely is it that the evidence would be at least this good against it? Alright? Let me put it differently. Suppose we were tossing the coin 1,000 times, and it came up 506 heads. Do you think 506 heads is at all likely? Very, very likely. Right? So that's there. The fact that 506 heads is very unlikely, because any specific result with 1,000 coins is unlikely. It could be 500, 501, 502. Each of those is unlikely. Let me take the standard example is, how many of you have played bridge? How do you play bridge? It's a dead game. Alright, you know roughly how bridges play? 4 players, suits matter. You sit down at a table imagining that you play bridge. You sit down at a table to play bridge and they deal out the whole deck of cards, 13 cards to each person. And you pick up your hand and it consists of 13 cards. And you notice that the other 3 players are also looking very surprised. And after a while you discover that the deal is 13 hearts, 13 spades, 13 clubs, and 13. What conclusion do you reach?
Didn't shuffle.
Well, not shuffling is not going to give you that result.
Well, yeah, with a regular deck, when you get it brand new, they're all...
The way you deal is 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, so that wouldn't give it to you. You're right, if you dealt 13, 13, 13, 13, and they came out as... No, a much stronger result than that. Someone has obviously rigged that deck. Somebody is a practical joke. Set up the deck so that every 4th card was a spade and every 4th card was a heart. You can calculate quite easily what the odds of that deal are. They're astronomically high against them. But you think a little longer and you realize that they're equally astronomically high against every other deal. Any particular allocation of those cards is equally unlikely. Does that make sense? Yep.
That's only if you try and figure out.
Well,
it's not that unlikely that you get a random mixture of...
Any particular random mixture, sure. Not just suits. No, I'm talking about the whole allocation. The whole allocation, which consists of, I had the 8 of hearts and the 4 of spades and the 7 of clubs and so forth. That particular allocation, the chance of my getting any particular 13 cards is the same as any other particular 13 cards. So what's special about all hearts is not really that it's less likely than any other allocation, but that it's more likely when somebody rigged the deck. That we have an alternative explanation, as it were. And therefore we're going to end up pooling all of the ordinary ones if they were single event, and then the all suits to each person as the unlikely one. So anyway, so what you would do is to ask how likely is the evidence this strong? So you say, what are the chances that you would get either 7 heads, 8 heads, 9 heads, or 10 heads? And what you're really trying to find out is if the rule having got 7 heads leads me to include an unfair coin, how often will I be wrong? That's one way of putting it. And for that, well, if I'm going to count it as unfair for 7, I'll certainly count it as unfair for 8, 9, or 10. But of course, I will also on that basis count it as unfair for 7 tails. This is a two-tailed task. I have no reason to assume it'll be heads rather than tails. So the real question in this case is, what is the combined probability of 7 or more heads out of 7 or more tails? And if that event is quite unlikely, then I say that looks like a reason to suspect that it's not a fair coin. I don't want to make a stronger statement than that, because that gets complicated. But the way that's put is that if the probability that it will be at least 7 one way or the other is under 0.05, we describe that as the null hypothesis being rejected at the 0.05 level. Alright? And that normally statistical confidence results are given in that language, that people will say, if they're being precise, we have rejected the null hypothesis at such and such a level. Meaning, the probability that if the null hypothesis is true, we would have gotten results this strong against it is only that high. So similarly, for my DNA testing, the claim is if these two blood stains are from separate people, unrelated people, then the chance that by chance they would match as closely as they do is only 1/1,000,000. We'll continue this later. And you can also read the chapter title. I think I've covered everything. The question number is the plastic dot. And at some point, you may want to go to your asking question to tell the prices. Any questions so far, by the way? Take a look at the what does it mean, think about it.
Professor Friedman, have you read the chapter by any chance?
Not in the last week.
Okay.
I had a question about one of the examples.
Show it to me, sure.
It says that on the session on testing hypotheses, it has an example where Maria says averaging